And good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Thursday, October 10th. It is a fairly clear morning considering smoke's in the forecast, and with more about what we can expect, we have ABC4 meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning, Connor. Good morning, Thatch back. Yes, still dealing with some of the smoky skies, but otherwise beautiful conditions as we kick off Thursday, Friday Eve, as we like to call it. Temperatures climbing yet again to the mid-70s. Looked up the record high today for Park City, at least the library station that we have in our database showing the record is 77 degrees for today. We're looking at 76 in Park City. That 77 was set back in 1999. So near record high temperatures. We had a record high. We tied it in Salt Lake yesterday. We're expecting to tie it again today. So the warmth continues. Another 76 tomorrow with some hazy skies. Overnight lows in the low 50s. We will start to see some increased cloud cover over the weekend. There's a trough of low pressure that we've been tracking. Impacts still look pretty minimal as far as any chances of moisture, but it should start to take the edge off of these near record high temperatures, sliding into the low 70s this weekend for daytime highs. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s. Average high this time of year for Park City is usually in the upper 50s. So still staying above average, even by 10 degrees early next week with temperatures in the upper 60s. We have just a small threat of a shower, 10 to 20% chance of a slight chance of moisture Sunday into Monday next week. Might even linger into Tuesday, depending on this storm system. Again, model still trying to hammer out some of the timing of it. Heber looking at smoky skies, low 80s today. Overnight lows into the low 40s, should be 81 tomorrow. Partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies this weekend. Again, slight chance of a shower on Sunday, Monday, with mostly sunny skies returning next week. Temperatures falling to the mid-70s for highs. Overnight lows in the mid-30s.
All right, ABC's Nate Larson, thanks so much. And a bit of a high-priority traffic update today. It's not accident-related, but it appears to be construction-related there on eastbound/southbound US 40 toward Heber. The usual backup in front of the exit off of 80 onto 40 has begun for your morning commute, but then once you turn onto 40 there, it will be down to one lane. So that can be expected to take you a bit longer if you're continuing toward Heber. The backup does begin before exit 2, so even if you're getting off at Silver Summit there, it appears to it's going to take you longer than it usually does, despite that backup already beginning on 80. So I see it stretching from about 40 to Kemble Junction, and then once you get onto 40, the backup starts around Quinns Junction. So it looks like that corridor is going to be pretty slow this morning. If you haven't hit the road yet, I recommend that you do. But the weekend is approaching, and here with an update on trails in the Wasatch Back, we have the Executive Director of the Mountain Trails Foundation, Laura Anthony. Good morning.
Good morning, and happy Thursday, Park City. Looks like we don't have a lot going on the trails. Basin Rec is reporting that they have started trail marking and mowing for Nordic and commuter paths for the winter prep. Same with Mountain Trails. Alec is remarking that if you're out and about, you see pink ribbons and a bunch of PVC piping, don't be startled. They don't bite. We have Wasatch Trails Foundation reporting in that they have a community movie night on Wednesday, 10/23. So that'll be October 23rd. They will be showing a mountain bike movie of the summer, anytime, and also summer days, a short made by a group from the Wasatch High School. How about this? For more information, check wasatchtrails.org and have a great day out there. It's supposed to be really nice. Hopefully the smoke will be trending east and we can all get out on our trails and enjoy some fresh air.
Fingers crossed.
That's it?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's Executive Director of Mountain Trails, Laura Anthony. Thanks so much. Well, I mentioned the backup growing on eastbound/southbound U.S. Highway 40. It's down to one lane just after the exit, after you get off of eastbound I-80. But the only other traffic thing to keep in mind in the Wasatch Back currently is the ongoing closure of Highway 35 above Francis and Woodland in the Uintas. That's due to the ongoing Yellow Lake fire. The latest is that safety concerns have increased for some areas near Wasatch County's Yellow Lake fire. heightened readiness orders for residents who may have to evacuate the Grand Daddy Lakes area of Ashley National Forest and the town of Hannah in Duchesne County are now under a set order. That's one step above the previous ready order. Under the new order, residents should have bags packed and be ready to evacuate at a moment's notice. Mandatory evacuation orders for the north and west forks of the Duchesne River remain in effect. The Yellow Lake Fire in eastern Wasatch County was nearly 20,000 acres and about 20% contained. And the Yellow Lake Fire spokesperson, Brian Trick, said the severity of the fire increased yesterday, and the California's Interagency Incident Management Team 2 took over from Northern Utah's Type 3 management team. The U.S. Forest Service reports the variable winds are keeping firefighters busy, especially in areas where the blaze has threatened cabins along the North Fork of the Duchesne Ridge. However, no buildings have been lost thanks to protective measures. Crews have significantly slowed the fire's growth near the Soapstone Road. The Heart Lake area at the southwest corner of the fire remained challenging because of how hot it's burning. On the southeast side, Trick says a retardant line has helped contain the burn along Highway 35.
Highway 35 remains closed, and what has to happen before we can open that is just kind of the fire activity itself to subside, or just for us to have an idea that the access for the public on that would not either be a threat to them or a burden to fire operations.
Three scooper planes have made runs to Strawberry Reservoir. That was on Tuesday. The U.S. Forest Service notes that while air attacks support ground crews, they do not suppress highly active fires. Residents learned more about the wildfire and future containment efforts at a community meeting yesterday at the Duchesne County Centennial Event Center. And the Duchesne County Fire and Office of Emergency Services will host a town hall tonight at 6 p.m. That's the old high school gym in Tabiana. More information is at kpcw.org. That's where we're posting all the latest updates on the Yellow Lake Fire. Well, coming up later in the hour here on KPCW, we'll be speaking with Summit County Council member Candace Hart. He'll recap yesterday's council meeting, then Park City Special Events and Facilities Coordinator Chris Finney and Facilities and Filming Coordinator Heather Weinstock have details on Shot Ski this weekend and the coming Halloween on Maine. Finally, Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang previews their upcoming screenings. Breaking news last night, the Utah Department of Transportation admitted yesterday it waited too long to choose a route for the Heber Valley Bypass. The agency now says the process will be, quote, much more painful. As KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports, none of the five options UDOT was considering will work any longer.
Wasatch County leaders have been discussing plans for a bypass to pull traffic away from Heber's Main Street for decades. In 2022, UDOT announced five possible routes west of Heber. Since then, its final decision has been delayed and then delayed again. And on Wednesday night, UDOT leaders told the Wasatch County Council and a room of about 40 residents the agency had waited too long. Now, none of the five routes will be enough to meet the valley's needs. UDOT Executive Director Carlos Becerras admitted the agency, quote, wasn't forward-thinking enough. Now, he says, any solutions to the county's traffic problems will be, quote, much more painful. Braceras says UDOT needs to come up with new routes altogether and tweak the existing proposals. As he told the council, a path through the North Fields is still being considered. Many people in the crowded room yelled out no. He described a grade-separated road as a possibility, with a widened US 40 and frontage roads on the sides for local traffic. He said that would provide a more direct path for traffic.
We need to look at something that's grade separated, that provides what I call less friction for those cars that are passing through. And if you're going to drive more miles, it better be faster, easier. And so I'm guessing it's going to require more of a highway feel.
Councilmember Kendall Crittenden commented he doubted Heber City would be supportive of that idea. The council called for more communication from UDOT moving forward, and Braceras pledged to regain the community's confidence.
We will do what needs to be done to build back the trust of this council, of this community, to do the right thing in the right way.
But some in the room met that promise with skepticism. Here's Tracy Taylor, a member of the Wasatch Open Lands Board.
It's one thing to say it, but let's see how it moves forward. And everybody in this room can agree on one thing. The options are closing the more we wait. But to hear UDOT quite honestly say, oh, we should have known better 10, 20 years ago, it's like that's your job to plan ahead.
She says the delays divide the community. And while UDOT drafts new routes, with no timeline set, other community stakeholders are being affected. The county council voted to conserve over 200 acres of the North Fields in March, but on Wednesday, Utah Open Lands Executive Director Wendy Fisher said that easement can't receive federal funding until UDOT makes its plans clear.
We tried to find ways that we could keep the application alive, and at the end of the day, there wasn't any resolution that could come, and so the funding for the Gertsch property has been denied at this point, which means that the other funding sources are not going to come forward. So that's going to be a total loss of about $10 million.
She says funding couldn't be delayed, so Utah Open Lands and the landowners will need to restart the process from the beginning after UDOT announces the bypass route.
I think that it is unfortunate when something like this happens, because maybe there could have been a different outcome had we all been brought to the table.
Braceras says he doesn't know how soon UDOT can settle on a route. And even if the agency makes a quick decision, it's already planned how to spend its anticipated revenue from now until 2031. Braceras says UDOT is setting up more meetings with local governments to discuss possible paths forward. But as before, the timeline is unclear. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Summit County Council met in the Richens Building yesterday. Here with a recap of the meeting on the phone with me is Councilmember Candace Hart. Good morning, Candace.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I'll start at the beginning. You had a field trip of sorts to the Dakota Pacific property to look at the land that they're hoping to build on. There's the partnership area, sort of where the Richens Building exists now, and then there the rest of their independent project area where they hope to build housing to the west. Could you talk about where you were and what you saw?
Yeah, absolutely. We walked from the Richens Building, because really it's just across the street. So we walked across the street, met kind of up above the Skull Candy Building. And that road that goes, say, from, that's Landmark Drive, which is the one that's by the Transit Center. The road that goes perpendicular to that is Tech Center Drive. And we basically paralleled that. We walked it on what would be the north side up on a ridge. That's kind of by the Walmart side. We walked along that road back to the hills. Once we got to the hills, we crossed back over the other side of Tech Park and then came back. And we really just made a loop. And what we were doing was looking at the terrain, where it really drops off and where it's high points, low points, you know, that kind of thing. And we had an app, or I should say Dakota Pacific had an app that had their the rendering of the layout, and you could see your GPS coordinate, like your dot moving on the map. It was just on a phone, but you could see it. So you could say, oh, you're standing now at what would be a parking lot, or you're standing now at what would be a building of this type, and then have a conversation around what would have to happen to the land if it were to go forward.
Yeah, and I want to quickly pause for people that may not have heard about Dakota Pacific at all at this point. The plan is kind of currently planning a master plan for where the library is, sort of over to where Skull Candy is, to redo the Kimball Junction Transit Center, expand it a little bit, and move county services potentially into a new building and the Skull Candy Building, and then they have sort of residential neighborhoods planned to the west. I am curious about the terrain, because it seems like they've been able to leverage that in designs for a transit center, undergrounding some of the parking. When it comes to the rest of the project that the developer is proposing to you, does the terrain seem to help or hurt their plans?
That's a good question, because I guess you could view it either way. You know, imagine, so what's deceiving is when you're on this Tech Center Drive, it's actually a rather elevated road. Like, I drive it a lot, so when I look at it through the lens of, oh, here's the proposed development, you really notice then how high above, say, lower UOP you are. Even when you're on Tech Center Drive, you're over the roof of the Skull Candy Building. So it actually has a lot of ground that falls away. So I suppose if it's the glass is half full from a building perspective, if they sort of mellow out the fall line and then you build down below, you can actually hide the sort of massing of the buildings a little bit with some of that terrain. And then conversely, if you're on the other side of the road, it elevates the buildings. So it kind of just depends on what type of building it is, how tall the building would be, as to whether it's a pro or a con, but it's surprising for sure is how much change in height or elevation there is when you're in that area. And then, yeah, I think to your sort of the first point, you know, for someone who may not be as familiar with it, and I should say, guys, we really should almost just, we can have like a town hall or something. It'd be great to like, the hard part is we can never talk about an application with members of the public outside of the council meeting because we're legally obligated to have those conversations in the open there. And we would love nothing more than be able to just sort of have a coffee with someone or a town hall or sit down and really just sort of break it all down and explain it. But for anybody who's just sort of catching up on it, if we're over where the current library is and the current transit center, that would be proposed in that area. We would put a UDOT. Right now, we're working on the 224 interchange. So the first priority is obviously getting traffic kind of figured out in the whole 224 interchange piece. And then along with that, in that area where the library is now, would be two layers of underground parking, partially exposed on the 224 side, but because of the hill, the way it falls away, that would have up to about 1,000 parking spaces. Now, those parking spaces are for parts of like 400 spaces for a new transit center that's twice the size of the current one. And that transit center would move next to the visitor center, and it would have bus rapid transit. So there's a lot of things, and more than we could probably, you know, like describe over the radio. You would probably really want to see some pictures. But that whole area is really about capturing traffic, getting people on the transit, fixing up 224. That's where the county could own some affordable housing. As you start to move west in the project, the next, when you cross over Landmark, it really gets like more of a park amphitheater with pretty decent capacity of, you know, how many people could be in there. But it would go to a new library building, which would have two layers of parking under it. And that library building is, libraries are not like just for housing books anymore, right? They're really about community space, maker spaces, meetings, all the various things that take place as a community. So that's what that kind of building would be, and it would open up onto the park. Skullcandy building stays where it is. We would move county services to the ground floor. Skullcandy has a second floor. I should say Skullcandy has a second floor and little bits of the downstairs that they still need to maintain, like, you know, their servers are down there and stuff like that. And then as you go a little further
and Candace,
west.
I want to jump in here really quick, because for this idea, I think, to be the best version of itself, UDOT has to grant some additional egresses onto 224 there at the transit center to kind of help the buses circulate. Have they been involved in the conversations yet? What have they told you?
Oh, thanks. Yes, UDOT has been involved. They've given us the that should work, green light kind of thing. They'll basically have a turn in and turn out from the transit center on the 224, and that's contemplated in the new designs. And now I should say that UDOT's final version of what they want to build, that's not finalized yet. And then we expect to see that around March or so. But no, they're all happening in concert. I would say that UDOT is very much a part of the conversation.
Yeah, and this, of course, is also pending a vote of council from a project and just development side as well.
This is just the proposal is what we're talking about.
The tentative schedule is to make that vote before the end of the year. Do you think that can happen?
Well, I think so. It's for all the public who's, especially people that have opposed the project. One of the things that I've heard a lot is, you know, people are frustrated when they'll say like, well, why are you considering this, or why are you meeting with them? And it's, we're legally obligated to have the meetings, and the council has actually never voted. We actually are in the middle of a legal fight right now, and that's just suspended while we're working through all of this. So for all the time that this has been going on, the council's actually never taken a vote. And so we have to do that, whether it's a yes or no. We just have to actually vote and fulfill that responsibility. And we think we can get that done maybe like early December, like late November, early December, something in that time frame, to find out what we are or we are not doing.
Yeah, and I want to touch on the other thing you visited yesterday around noon, the cemetery district's, preferred location there is just south of the project area. It's along Olympic Parkway, but it looks like it's moved down the road a little bit for similar terrain reasons. What did you see at the site visit?
Yeah, so there is a Snyderville Basin Cemetery district, and they've been trying to find a site to put a cemetery. Now, I think they have a slightly different version or a more modern take on what a cemetery would look like. We haven't seen any kind of renderings or drawings yet, but as they speak to us, they keep describing something that sounds different than an older cemetery. And of all the locations they've looked at, the one that they've really focused in on is that lower UOP area. So if you're going to climb the hill up to Utah Olympic Park, right there on your right-hand side as you're going up the hill, in that sort of flat grass, almost where we parked the cars in the 2002 Olympics, is the area that they're looking. And they've done tests to see if there's water in there and see if there's bedrock, you know, if they could actually site that. They've been talking with Basin Recreation about how they would co-mingle with a couple of the trails that sort of come right through there. And we just, at this point, saw what they've been working on. It's actually impressive that they've done as much as they have with no budget. And then the conversation turned into budget related pieces.
Yeah, I was also curious. It was interesting to see the other areas they tested or looked at. I think one they mentioned was Klein Dolly. I think other stuff's contemplated for that parcel. But there's apparently a parcel by Mammoth Drive, the new connector between Silver Creek and Bittner. And I think I'd forgotten the county has land over there. Is there anything contemplated with that parcel of land right now?
Well, I have not. The only thing that sounds like I think they've kind of settled in on this area at lower UOP, but it's not decided yet, if that makes sense. So they're saying, hey, this is the area we think this would be the, of everything we've looked at, this is the place to go. And the council has not gotten to a point where they've, I guess, rendered a vote or made a decision like, yes, go there or not. So we probably would still have another meeting where we would dig into all the other sites they looked at. Of what I saw in the meeting, council members seemed favorable of this location, but I don't, there wasn't really an open discussion on are you in favor of it or not.
Yeah, and you mentioned budget. That is tentatively $495,000 for the district covering the Snyderville Basin for the average resident primary, I believe. That'd be about $14. There's not currently a tax on the bill right now for a cemetery, but that would be $14 for your average home value. Does council think that's a reasonable ask?
Yeah, I think so. I guess when I say that, that's my interpretation of what I heard from the other council members, and I can say I think so. In that, when you stand up a district like the cemetery district, it's like we have the fire district and we have the school district, and you have these very Basin Rec as its own taxing entity. Well, when you ask someone to form a cemetery district, you have to give them funds to work with. And it's a relatively modest ask right now. You know, like you were saying, at $14 to the average homeowner, nobody wants to pay more taxes, but it in of itself isn't probably going to be the thing that pushes someone over the top. But we cannot put ourselves in a position where we ask them to form a district and then don't give them any money to work with. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah, and more hearings on that before the council really votes
exactly
on it in December. The other thing is the council's own budget, or the county government's budget, which I was surprised to learn last week, I believe, that makes up about 20% of the average property owner's tax bill, the majority being the school district, especially in the Park City School District. But you're facing a shortfall. The latest number appears to be $7 million. It's really fluctuated throughout the different budget discussions, but you're initiating the truth in taxation process. You called that yesterday a backstop. Can you explain what you mean by that terminology?
Yeah, one, for everybody who's tracking on this, there's a couple things that I think kind of confuse the issue. So, you know, like myself personally, my property taxes have gone up every year the last 3 years in a row, and I've been seeing like 60 and 70% increases. So it would seem reasonable to a person to think that the county is just taking in, you know, bundles of more money. Actually, the county doesn't. The way the state tax authority works property tax, the county can take in no more money than it took in the year before, unless it's for like new construction or something. So it basically levels out without in the county. And you know, I'd be happy to explain it in more detail at any point that someone wants to get into the weeds on it. But we don't really take any more money. And so what people wouldn't realize is the county actually has not raised our general fund or municipal fund. That's where the county gets money. We haven't raised those since 2017. So when you think about the inflation we're all facing, the county has faced that over the years, and then you've got the cost of services, et cetera. So the whole thing is a little confusing just in that most people would say, hey, my property tax has gone up, but it's actually been these other districts that have either risen it or the property valuation has taken someone's tax up. So the county really is operating on less and less as we go, and you really shouldn't wait that long before you make an adjustment. But in addition to that, when we say that the county has a shortfall, it's not like we're, it's a kind of interesting way to phrase it. Basically, the county manager presents a budget proposal to the county council, and then the council can agree or not agree with that. And like last year, as an example, we would have said there was a shortfall at this stage, but we said, no, we don't want to raise taxes. What can we cut or what can we defer to bring that back down to zero? And so technically last year we had a shortfall as well, right? But then we went back and reworked it. And so what you're seeing right now is the council, the county, kind of in this, for our part of it, the staff has worked on it for a long time, but we're kind of in the early to stages of finalizing a budget. So we don't even know what the final budget number will be. That's part of what you wanna watch over the next few weeks. And then, you know, at that point we address what we would either have as a deficit or not. And then you would do that through, and then the two options on the table right now is there's gonna be a sales tax for 0.5%, which is the emergency services tax. That's Proposition 18 on the ballot. Voters decide if that happens or not. And then the other option is to increase property taxes. And so last night we were just reserving the option to do that.
And the third option being cuts, I think we're short on time, but if folks want to see some of the things that, you know, maybe cut, if you take that third option, that's listed in the latest meeting agenda at the summitcounty.org website. We are out of time, Candace. Is there anything else you want to mention before you go?
No, just a big picture. If it's Dakota Pacific you're interested in, attend the next meetings. We're still very much just talking through it, going towards the vote. If it's budget that has your attention, same thing. We're just really in the middle of it right now. So what you're seeing is the public process playing out live, and we really would love participation. So come to the meetings. You can catch us on Zoom, and you are always welcome to email us. If you go to the county website and you go to county council, there's a button there. You can email everybody all at once. And other than that, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Summit County Council member Candace Hart. The Park City Council is considering a property owner's request to remove an old town home from the city's list of historic sites. KPCW's Parker Malatesta explains.
Park City has more than 400 properties that are designated as significant or landmark historic sites. Most of them are concentrated in the Old Town neighborhood, and some date back to the late 1800s during the height of the town's mining industry. At its meeting Thursday, the Park City Council will review a request to remove the lot at 37 Hillside Avenue from the historic list. That structure was built around 1885 in the early mining era. The home avoided the damage wrought by the Great Fire of 1898, which destroyed most of Park City. The new owner of the property contends that the original structure was altered decades ago and that recent renovation projects use materials that don't meet the historic standard. The city's Historic Preservation Board previously denied the request from the property owner. Park City Manager Matt Dias said preserving historic sites remains a top priority for the city, but private property owners have the right to make their case.
We have spent tens of thousands of dollars and hundreds of thousands of hours preserving many of these assets. But that's not to say that private property owners don't have their own opinions about their property and its future disposition and uses. And we have a public process for obviously redevelopment, renovation, and how someone may or may not contest these historic findings or designations of their property. And that's what's occurring here up on Hillside Avenue.
Park City Municipal Spokesperson Clayton Scrivener said properties have been removed from the historic register through this process in the past. But Scrivener emphasized each property is subject to a unique set of conditions, standards, and restrictions. Also on Thursday, the City Council will receive its annual update from the Park City Senior Center and consider appointing 7 members to serve on the city's Nonprofit Services Advisory Committee. The new committee will be charged with making recommendations about how the city should allocate grants to local nonprofits. Thursday's meeting begins at 4:40 p.m. at City Hall following a closed session. The agenda and a link to attend virtually can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, Park City Shotski is this weekend, and here with me in the studio to talk about that and the coming Halloween celebrations, we've got the Park City Special Events and Facilities Coordinator, Chris Finney, and Facilities and Filming Coordinator, Heather Weinstock. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Heather, maybe we'll begin with you, because Shotski is first. It's this weekend, Saturday. You know, what can you tell us about some of the rearrangements that have to happen in Old Town?
Yeah, so this is the 8th annual Shotski. It is put on by Sunrise Rotary Club, and all of the proceeds go to benefit local grant programs, and we're excited to have it back. Every year, they try and raise a bunch of money. This year, they're going for $60,000 and setting a new world record, 1,385 shots. According to the website, the event is sold out, but they have been able to accommodate walk-ups in the past, so be sure to come check it out. We do have impacts that you'll want to look out for this Saturday. The event is held on Upper Main Street from Heber Ave to the top of Main. Heber Avenue will remain open, but we will plan on closing the road Upper Main at 8 a.m. and it's anticipated to reopen by 4 p.m. at the latest. For the event itself, they'll start checking people in at noon and the shot will take place promptly at 2 p.m. We are pushing free parking and free transit from Richardson Flat. We have our normal 6 Silver Line, runs every 40 minutes with the first bus leaving at 6:45 a.m. and the last bus at 7:45 p.m. But during those peak event times from about 10 a.m. until 3 p.m., we will be increasing service with 20-minute frequencies.
And a lot of times you will do the dedicated bus lane on Deer Valley Drive. Will that come back this Saturday?
We will not be for a Shotski.
Okay, gotcha. But with 1,385, I guess you're anticipating that and then some for
yeah,
traffic.
Yeah, so in the past, and we will have parking still in Old Town. New this year, China Bridge, it will be a $15 flat rate instead of free. So, you know, as I said, we are encouraging that free transit, and so that Richardson Flat park and ride is a great option for people. And then we do have a new taxi rideshare drop-off location. Typically, we do that in the South Marsac lot right by City Hall, but due to construction to fix the retaining wall there, we have actually moved that drop-off location to the top level of China Bridge. So that's another great option. Carpool, we want everybody to stay safe.
All right. And yeah, you mentioned parking because I think it's free right now, especially due to the waterline construction on Main Street. Mm-hmm. This is one of those exceptions for special events.
Yes. Yep.
The other event being Halloween on Main. Chris, could you talk a little bit about some of the shutdowns that have to happen? I think Main Street entirely gets closed.
Yeah, that's right. So our annual trick-or-treating event is on Main Street on Halloween. So come in your best costumes. We'll be shutting Main Street down to a pedestrian only from the top of Main all the way down to 9th Street. So Heber Avenue will be closed on that. Transit will be rerouted down Deer Valley Drive onto 9th Street and then onto Park Ave. So all of those routes will still be open and just a little bit of reroute. As Heather mentioned, we will be pushing and asking everyone to take transit. We'll be doing a 10-minute frequency from Richardson Flat starting at 2:15. And the last bus from the Old Town Transit Center leaves at 7:45 p.m. to Richardson Flats, so try to plan ahead. If you are going to drive in town, we do have some free parking lots in the Sandridge lot. We are working with our resort partners over in Deer Valley and Park City Mountain as well, so you can park there and either walk or take a bus from there. If you do drive into town, please take your time and plan ahead. Watch out for some kids. As you mentioned, we will have a bus lane set up on Deer Valley Drive starting at 2 p.m., so that'll help you get into town a little easier. If you do drive in, China Bridge has a $15 flat fee as well, just like Shotski, so we'll be doing that. All of our normal pass holders can park in their normal spots, so if you're an employee, you can still park in Flagpole or Gateway. Everything else, we're asking to try to park in North Marsac. If those fill up, then try to go into China Bridge, but you'll be able to use your passes at that time. Any of the drop and load areas, just like Shotski, we'll be using the top of China Bridge over on the top there.
All right. And historically, is Halloween the event that draws more people to town? Do you know which one gets more crowded?
It's very crowded, so that's why I said take your time. We'll be... pretty full on the street from 3 to 6, trick-or-treating.
And as I mentioned, parking is currently free except for these special events. Are there any other events that people should be aware of coming up or anything else you want to mention?
We will double check, but I believe it's free parking except for these two special events. These are our last two big ones of the year.
All right. We've been speaking with Chris Finney. He's the Park City Special Events and Facilities Coordinator, and Heather Weinstock is the Facilities and Filming Coordinator for Park City Municipal. Thanks for joining us today. Anything else you want to mention?
No, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Park City Film has a full slate of fall offerings. Here to go through it is the Executive Director of PC Film, Katie Wang. Good morning.
Good morning, Connor. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. So tonight you have a film called Beyond Zero. It's an entrepreneur sort of autobiographical film or documentary feature. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, we're super excited about this film. 7 o'clock. It's a free screening. We're partnering with Park City Lodging to help them celebrate their 40th anniversary, which is always a big deal. We're 30, so we're a little younger than them. But appropriately enough for them, if you know anything about Rhonda and Helena Sedaris, they're hosting this free film screening about a business that basically decided to go beyond compliance, which is, you know, the minimum standard, and not just do better, but make a positive change and provide leadership around sustainable practices and carbon reduction. There will be a panel discussion after the film. We'll have Andy Hetch there from the Park City Community Foundation, Megan Richer, who's an architect and co-founder of Place Collaborative, which is an architecture firm here in town. Lynn Peake from KBCW will be the moderator, but just a great community conversation about what can we do to combat climate change? What can businesses do? What can individuals do? You know, what is going on within our community that we can celebrate and elevate? So it'll be a great night. That's at 7 o'clock. It is free admission, so you can register in advance or just show up. We'd love to have you. And then we have a great slate of both weekend films and special films. As you said, we have just accumulated. I feel like there's a lot more films that are programmed than we normally have this time of year, which is a great thing because, of course, we love film. So starting off this weekend, we are bringing back a Sundance Film Festival film. We've got a couple of those on our slate here. It's called Didi, and it's with Sean Wang as the director. It won the Audience Award at the 2024 Film Festival, also a special jury prize. And it's just a fantastic coming-of-age story about a Taiwanese-American boy in the last month of summer before high school begins. So many of us have been there, and you know it's just that transition point of life of, you know, you're coming into kind of your sort of adulthood and just figuring out what life's all about and kind of how you fit into the world and your family. So beautiful film there. The next weekend we're back with Lee. This will be the weekend of October 18th. So folks that are still in town that aren't out for the weekend if they don't have kids, this is with Kate Winslet. And this is a story that has kind of not been well it's not well known. It's based on a true story of a war photographer and former Vogue model named Lee Miller. And she photographed, just really fought hard because women at the time were not allowed into the front lines during combat. This was World War II. And her pictures of the atrocities of World War II continue to shape how we view these events. I mean, she was just, you know, world-renowned at the time, and it's been sad that it's kind of been lost to history, but this film will bring it back, and Kate Winslet does a fantastic job. Then just in time for Halloween, we've got Beetlejuice, October 25th, and this is so the next generation gets to experience the supernatural caper with, of course, Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder, Jenna Ortega. It's just another classic by the weird and talented mind of Tim Burton. If you're familiar with the original Beetlejuice, which was one of my favorite films when I was a kid, this film just kind of brings it all back and takes it to the next level. So a fun sequence there. And then we've got two ski films, actually, this year, which is kind of fun to help us get into the winter mode and celebrate all things white and fluffy and deep powder here that we have in Utah. First on October 28th, which is a Monday, we have a special screening, and this is called The Girls Winter Ski Tour. And it's six films by and showcasing female skiers. There'll be a Q&A with the directors of the films. And really, it's just a celebration of women in snow sports. And of course, we have Park City's own Sierra Slog with her film Nisei. So she'll be on site. If you know Sierra, she's a fantastic athlete, community member, great storyteller. So it'll be really fun to see her film and celebrate her. Tickets for that special film are $20. So we want to help support that tour and get the girls' winter ski tour out and about into the community and around the world. So come see us for that one. And then that weekend, which will be the first weekend in November, We have our the newest film from Matchstick Productions, which is our annual celebration of winter, skiing, and adventure. It's called Calm Beneath Castles. And we'll have beer and wine for sale because, you know, ski films. Friday night, we'll have special VIP tickets, lots of swag. Great celebration, great way to bring in winter. It's always a fun time when folks come out for that. And then we kind of round off our weekend series with My Old Ass, which was a 2024 Sundance Film Festival premiere with Aubrey Plaza. Coming-of-age story where an 18-year-old ingests some psychedelics for her birthday and suddenly finds herself face-to-face with her 39-year-old self who's trying to give her advice. So great premise, fantastic film. It was definitely the talk of the festival. So lots of great weekend stuff coming up for sure.
Definitely. Oh, go ahead.
And then, yeah, we've got some other special screenings coming up. So next weekend, or next week rather, on Wednesday, we're showing a film called Show Her the Money. This is on Wednesday, October 16th at 7 p.m., and we're partnering with She Money. This documentary is about the power of funding female entrepreneurs, and the film follows four visionary entrepreneurs and the female angel investors who are helping them realize their true potential. As the film helps us acknowledge and realize that money is power and women need it to achieve true equality. So we'll have a great panel discussion with Catherine Gray, who's the founder of She Angel Investors, also a producer on the film, Jackie Zahner, who's the founder of She Money, Amy Sunderland of Grandeur Peak, and Kimmy Palach with Beta Boom. So we'll have a pre-film social with She Money at 5 o'clock if you're interested in that, and then film at 7. Tickets for those events start at $25. So you can join us for that great conversation before the film, at the film, after the film. Just a great opportunity to network and really get involved with the She Money community, which has been just kind of growing leaps and bounds over the last couple of years. And then last but not least, two special matinees. This weekend on Saturday at 4 o'clock, we have Olacin from the New York International Children's Film Festival. And this is a collection of Spanish language short films. Saturday, 4 o'clock, free admission and popcorn, recommended for ages 8 and up. The films will all be in Spanish with English subtitles, so you can practice your Espanol. And then November 9th at 4 o'clock is part of our family film fest series, Robot Dreams, which is a great film about a dog and his robot and the unbreakable ties of friendship. Also free popcorn. So a lot going on.
A lot going on there at the library. Yeah, it sounds like you're doing a lot of these post-film discussions. I mean, there's the one tonight. Is this something you're trying to increase? I don't know. Maybe I'm more plugged in than I used to be, and I'm just noticing it more.
No, I mean, it's always something that we try to do. I mean, it's kind of that balance of you could probably have a speaker every weekend, honestly, with the films that we're bringing in, because that's kind of how we are curating them. So they have something you can kind of digest and talk about, you know, whatever level we're bringing it in. But you don't want to exhaust people, right? Sometimes people just like to be entertained and just kind of relax. But, you know, I think the secret sauce for independent art house cinemas, as we are, is really that community connection. And so how do we connect what's going on in the film with the great conversations that are happening in our community? How do we elevate that? How do we bring people together in those conversations in a more intentional way? I mean, it's one thing to kind of put something on the screen and say, great, you can learn about Lee Miller and maybe have a conversation with the people next to you or your friends and family about what you've just seen. But, you know, with a film like Beyond Zero and certainly with Show Her the Money, it's like, how do you more intentionally kind of dig deeper and say, okay, here are people in this community that are doing things that you can either talk to them about or replicate or kind of dive deeper into? Because, you know, for me, it's always a challenge when you see a great documentary at, say, a film festival, and you're like, oh, I'm so interested in this topic. And then you go home and you're like, and it's, you know, I got to do the laundry and make dinner. You know, you just kind of go back to your regular life. But if you can have that extra conversation, then it gives you that opportunity to kind of take that newfound passion or interest and do something with it and say, great, yeah, I want to take that next step. Here are the resources to do it. And, you know, not everyone does, but the folks that are so motivated, it makes it easier for them to connect and share and elevate that and, again, kind of create that community. And that's, you know, kind of the heart and soul of what Park City Film does. So as much as we can see these opportunities, we try to elevate those. And there just happened to be a lot coming up in the fall, which is fantastic. So seize the moment. Makes for a busy program, but that's great. So, you know, more is more in the film world.
Yeah, well, at least for the time being, this is our only movie theater in the area. I mean, until Larry H. Miller Megaplex reopens the Redstone Theaters at Kimball.
Yep.
Have you been following that? What does Park City Film think about that coming back online?
We're excited. I mean, you know, with the world of film and film exhibition, COVID obviously was devastating for many reasons, you know, across the globe, certainly with the world of entertainment, the film exhibition industry hasn't bounced back as quickly as live events. Online streaming certainly is a big competitor for us. And so anything that can remind people of the magic of movie going, of being in a theater surrounded by 100 other people emoting, whether they're laughing or crying or cheering or whatever it is, I mean, that's such magic that you cannot get at home. I don't care what your home theater looks like. It's not the same when you're surrounded by 100 other people and just how they express, you know, what's going on and connect with what's happening on the screen. So having something like a Larry H. Miller, which from what I've heard, they're going to, you know, the renovation is going to be amazing. They're going to bring it up to the standards of their theaters down in Salt Lake, which are great. But, you know, people who love movies go see movies where they are. And so if they have the opportunity to go down to this great theater in Kimball Junction, then they come to Park City Film and see something different, because our programming, of course, will be slightly different than theirs. That's great, right? It's just, it reminds people, gets them back into the habit of going to movie theaters. You know, I've had so many people ask me, they're like, oh, you know, are you gonna bring in this movie? How about that movie? You know, can you bring in Beetlejuice? Because I really don't want to go down to Salt Lake to see it, but I really want to see the movie. And so anything we can kind of tip that balance of like, yes, the movie's here, see it, whether it's us or Larry H. Miller, you know, that's kind of seize that moment and get people back in the habit. So we're excited to have them online. I don't know when, so I don't have any special insider information on that, but I've heard, you know, they said the holidays. My assumption is that would be Christmas time and certainly for Sundance.
Yeah, if people do want to suggest things they want to see come to the Jim Santee Auditorium, is there a right way to do that? Do they just email?
Yeah, just email. See me on the street. I see people in the grocery store all the time. Like, I heard your voice on the radio. Are you Katie? Which is hilarious. So you guys have gotten my voice out there into the world. But no, send me an email. It's Katie, K-A-T-Y, at parkcityfilm.org. I always love hearing suggestions. You know, sometimes we're not always able to program, obviously, everything that comes in. But, you know, I go to festivals and certainly do my due diligence in terms of films that I think will be great to bring to the community. But this town is so creative and has so many connections to the world. We brought in a great film called Maya and the Wave about Maya Gabeira, who's a Brazilian surfer. And that was a suggestion from a community member. She just reached out to me and she said, hey, my friend had this film at the Toronto Film Festival. I think it would be great here in the community. And I had not heard of it. So we took a look and we're like, this is amazing. And we were able to get it before it was released. And, you know, it was just kind of one of those great serendipitous moments. So absolutely, please reach out. We always want to hear suggestions. You know, our intent is to connect to the community through film. That's our mission. So as much as we can get input from folks, we're happy to get that.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Katie Wang. She's executive director of PC Film. And just to recap, tonight, the latest slate of showings kicks off at 7 with Beyond Zero. That's a film about sustainable business practices with a post-film discussion about that. Then this weekend, it's Didi, a favorite from this year's Sundance Film Festival. Katie, is there anything else you want to mention today?
Yep. So Olacine is the third one for our busy weekend, a matinee screening that's free, short films in Spanish. Folks can go to parkcityfilm.org, get information on all those films, because I know it's a lot of information, get tickets online. We also open the box office an hour before showtime. So if you're not comfortable buying your tickets online or just have a last minute change of plans, please just show up at the door. We have a huge, beautifully renovated theater, 450 seats. We'd love to have you. So lots coming up, and we look forward to seeing our community at the movies.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Summit County will not issue open burn permits this season until fire dangers drop to moderate or below. The fire warden says unseasonably dry and hot weather and poor air quality from the Yellow Lake fire make open burns unsafe for incorporated and unincorporated areas of the county. On October 4th, the county issued the fire danger from moderate to very high. More information how to sign up for text alerts from the county is at kpcw.org. And it is National Fire Prevention Week. The Red Cross is raising awareness about how to stay safe in case of a fire. Here's KPCW's Christine Weller.
National Fire Prevention Week is the week of October 9th to mark the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. The blaze began on October 8th, 1871, and killed more than 250 people, left 100,000 homeless, destroyed more than 17,000 structures, and burned more than 2,000 acres of land. Jeremiah LaFranca is the Greater Salt Lake Chapter Director for the Red Cross of Utah. He says the best way to prevent a house fire is to ensure all smoke alarms work.
Oftentimes people hear the chirping going on in the background, right? I think we've all experienced that. People get annoyed by that. They'll take the smoke alarms out, and then they don't put them back in, or they just don't change the batteries and let it die. That creates a difficult situation. You know, more than 60% of home fire deaths are related to homes that don't have working smoke alarms.
He says a smoke alarm should be in every bedroom and they should be tested monthly. LaFranca says his organization will check and install free smoke alarms in local homes.
It's KPCW's Christine Weller reporting.
Hi, this is Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development, a supporter of KPCW. One of our core missions is to give back to the community where we live, work, and play. PC Tots was established to address the lack of early childhood care in our own backyard. When a child has access to quality early childhood care and education, they have the best prospects to excel in school and in the community. For more information on how to be involved, on the web at pctots.org.
And a quick warning here, this next report discusses some issues that may be upsetting to some listeners. A part-time employee of the Park City Mark has been arrested and now charged with felony child sex abuse. 25-year-old Patrick Robert Baker of Salt Lake City is being held without bail in the Salt Lake County Jail for attempting to molest a 5-year-old boy. The Park City Mark confirmed Baker worked as a seasonal lifeguard and swimming instructor this summer. Previously, Baker served as the teen director for the Boys and Girls Club in Murray. According to court documents, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security arrested him on September 30th.